As many in our nation finally take a long overdue look at race and racism, it's obvious that the systemic injustices built into our system and society include both economic and other forms of discrimination. Among the most disrespected are LGBTQ persons of color. And that's why I thought it essential to focus on this population in light of the Supreme Court's ruling on workplace protections. Very grateful to be joined by David J. Johns, Executive Director of the National Black Justice Coalition and a veteran of the Obama administration. David, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Walton, for making space, in particular, to have an incredibly uncomfortable conversation about race and racism in America.
I think few of us expected such an unambiguously affirming statement out of this court. Do you remember what you were thinking and feeling when you heard the news?
Absolutely. I heard the news as I was drafting a statement honoring the life of two Black trans women who were murdered on Friday. Two Black trans women who, before the Supreme Court issued their decision around Title VII employment discrimination. So for those who don't know, prior to Monday, it was legally permissible to deny one access to employment based on actual or perceived sexual identity and gender orientation or expression. And so I've always been aware of the reality that while I was born in Inglewood, California, my parents were both born and raised in Austin, Texas. And what that means is that I could, prior to this week, have put a picture on my desk of me and one of my friends. And my employer could have assumed that that was my partner and I could have been fired. It is significant for me that that is now not the case specific to employment. And it is unnerving that it is still legally permissible to discriminate against people regarding housing, public housing in this country, and what we call legally public accommodations. And so the point here is that so many of the fights that were waged heretofore, right? There's so many reflections in this current moment about this larger movement for this protracted struggle for radically inclusive social justice, right? So many of these efforts and fights that have been waged have led people to believe that the work has been done, right? That all of us who are American citizens have the ability to show up in places, in public places, without the threat or harm of being discriminated against or being the victim of a hate crime, right? And the reality is that for so many of us, especially those of us who face the twin evils of racism and homophobia, and homophobia's cousins, transphobia and biphobia and transmisogyny noir, which is a term that was created to talk about the unique ways that patriarchy and misogyny and racism and transphobia affect the lives of Black trans women. And so this is a really long way of saying, yes, I will always remember because I'm often placed in positions of having to celebrate important victories while also remembering that there are too many members of our community, Black queer people, who are dying for the rights that other people, mostly privileged white people, privileged heterosexual people, I'm doing air quotes for people who can't see, take for granted.
Yeah. What are the members and constituencies that you work with most thrilled by in this justice decision?
A legal declaration from the Supreme Court of the United States, in particular this Supreme Court, that affirms that you cannot discriminate against someone with regard to employment based on actual or perceived sexual identity, gender orientation, or expression is important. It is an affirmation that, in fact, all of our lives matter, which I say acknowledging the irony of people that have access to white privilege asserting that when people are essentially reminding everyone that in order for that statement to be true first, all Black lives have to matter too, right? And so that that decision and that law is important. However, policy is a lagging indicator. laws matter when you are able to bring a suit to court or seek formal redress. What we have to be mindful of is that there's still a whole lot of work to be done to change the ways in which people show up, employers show up, doctors show up, frontline service providers like police officers show up, such that we are not discriminated against, we are not victims of hate crimes, and we don't need to file lawsuits in order to have the basic civil protections that so many people continue to die for. Mm-hmm.
What are some of the other tangible benefits that will come out of this, do you think?
There are at least three that come to mind. One is that we're having this conversation. There are so many more people, including the justices, who I have enjoyed watching increase their competence. And the ways in which they have worked through some of this publicly has not always felt good as a member of this community. But the fact that more people are talking is important. We have to have conversations like this. We have to learn how to argue better. And so we should understand that in and of itself is a significant victory. The second thing is this honoring the lives of the plaintiffs, including those who are not here to celebrate this victory with us, is that there will be so many more people who will not be discriminated against, who will not be locked out of necessary economic opportunities, and who will otherwise have the opportunity to participate in the what is often myth of the American dream. And so ensuring that people have access to employment, to housing, to basic medical needs, to quality public education, those are the kinds of things that we know allow our communities to be strong and our country to be healthy. And we should all be concerned about the erosion of that, in particular, while there's someone in the Oval Office who, if there's one thing that he's been clear and consistent in, it's deciding not to lead. Right. And so that's the second thing. The third thing is that there are so many more young people who identify as trans and who do not, who are demanding that we more aggressively and more meaningfully shift both policy and practice so that everybody has the ability to show up without, again, threat of discrimination or harm.
David, I know countless Americans were unaware that there were not already these kinds of workplace protections in effect nationwide. What complicates the issue when we look at LGBTQI plus persons of color? What don't many Americans still not know about the systemic challenges they continue to face?
I appreciate that question, and I'm going to take a little bit of time to work through this because it's complicated. The first thing is that we in America do not talk about race enough. When we think we do, we often end up talking about Black people, and we end up pathologizing them and talking about all of the problems that the world has been led to believe that Black people both cause and create. Seldom do we have conversations about whiteness. Seldom do we talk about the privileges that people who are able to identify as white have. And seldom do we talk about the role of racism in supporting systems such that white people have social, economic, and political privileges that other people simply don't have because they are not white. Period, full stop. For folks for whom they will have a challenging time hearing the words that are coming out of my mouth because I am a Black queer man, there are well-meaning white people who have been saying this for some time. Jane Elliott has talked about this publicly. Robin DiAngelo has written books about it. And there are now at least 400 years of history, many of it documented, a lot of it documented now on body cameras of police officers and through cell phones that citizens have. And before that, documented in the pages of the Crisis magazine, when we think about the height of lynching in this country, which continues to happen to this day. And so a part of why this is so uncomfortable for so many people is we have not learned to talk about and name race or whiteness or racism and anti-Blackness and homophobia, in part because it makes people uncomfortable. It should. If it makes you uncomfortable to talk about it, imagine how uncomfortable it is to live in it. That's one. The second thing is that a manifestation of the flattening of race results in people not appreciating all of these nuances. And so when we think about the ways that people write and publish books, the television shows that are aired, the movies that have been created, there's a way in which the world, and in particular white people, have imagined that all Black people are the same, that we are all from the same place in Africa, which is a continent, not a country, that we all live in major metropolitan cities, mostly in public housing, that we all don't know our fathers or have relationships with them, when the statistics show that Black men are more likely to have relationships with their children, in spite of the fact that they might not be living in the household, right? We fail to appreciate that these images, these myths, what Black feminists refer to as signs, systems, and symbols that allow this matrix of domination to work, are always operating. And they're always operating to prevent us from having these conversations and from doing this kind of work. And so in practice, the last thing is that most people think that all Black people are heterosexual. And conversely, too many people think that all queer people or all gay people are white. That is in part a result of the way that language works. If I were to talk about being an American without saying I'm a Black American, because of the way that power works, the formal term is hegemony, the assumption is that I'm talking about white. The same thing happens now if you ask the average person on the street, what are the biggest victories in the LGBTQ community, or what are the biggest priorities in the LGBTQ community? If you don't qualify, they're most likely going to speak to white people's things. Mm-hmm. It is why I don't use the term gay, because gay is a political identifier for white men. And then secondarily, if people do the work, white lesbian women. I use the term same gender loving to complicate those normative assumptions and this idea that people are easily fit into these narrowly constructed boxes, that they're either and only a boy or a girl, or you're Black or you're white, or you're heterosexual or you're homosexual. All these terms were created. And the way in which we experience them is a result of the lies that we have been told. And so much of what is important about now is reminding people that words matter and there's power and precision, and that there are so many of us, right? Not just Black queer people, but there are people who are Afro-Caribbean and people who are not native to this country and who are living with a disability, right? Like, these are the things that we should draw strength from and not continue to think of as different being a deficit.
David, it's been really encouraging to see Black trans lives explicitly lifted up at many of the Black Lives Matter rallies around the country and around the world. I'd like for you to talk about why that is so very important, if you would.
I will. And I want to honor that I am struggling with not sharing the same sense of elation in people saying or writing or hashtagging that Black trans lives matter. Mm-hmm. I say that in particular because just this morning I authored and NBJC issued yet another statement because Selena Reyes Hernandez, a 37-year-old trans woman from Marquette Park, Chicago, Illinois, was murdered. This is not the first statement that I have written. In fact, in this month of June alone, it is probably the seventh statement that I have written about violence specifically against Black trans women. And the irony of that is that you and I are having this conversation in June, which is Pride Month, which is in effect an extension of Black History Month, because there would be no Pride if it were not for Marsha P. Johnson, a Black trans woman who was responsible for resisting the police violence that too many queer people experienced at Stonewall Inn, a bar in New York City that existed because 51 years ago, there was a law that allowed bar owners to discriminate against queer people, to not serve them liquor because there was a belief that queer people couldn't handle their liquor. Again, a reminder that these laws are constructed by people and these social constructs matter. But Marsha P. Johnson resisted police violence in about a week to the day that you and I are having this conversation. And then for 6 days thereafter, there were protracted struggles. Yeah. struggles around the lives of Black trans women. And we didn't even have the term at that time. And so I'm tempered in my elation because it is important for people to say that Black trans lives matter, but it is even more important for that to actually be true. And until we are able to stop being introduced to Black trans women or having to endure the violence that Black women, both cis and trans, face, it feels like empty platitudes.
David, during the Obama administration, you led the White House initiative on educational excellence for African Americans. To go in just a few years from those heady days to the kind of deliberate incompetence and re-energized homophobia and racism that we're living with today, what keeps you going? How have you maintained your optimism and your focus in the face of so many setbacks?
Yeah, I appreciate that. I don't know that I would name what I feel optimism. Derrick Bell, who is a father of critical race theory, once a Harvard professor, talks about racial realism as a framework that allows us to accept and appreciate that race and racism is a fundamental part of the American experience. And acknowledging it for what it is allows me freedom to be able to identify, dismantle, and disrupt systems that have literally been designed to marginalize people who look like me, whose skin has been kissed by the sun, who love in ways that are not celebrated in Hollywood studios, unless it's June and it's Pride Month and it's in vogue, pun intended. Mm-hmm. And what gives me hope is recognizing and appreciating that this isn't just about this moment. To be clear, this moment is important, but this is a larger movement for radically inclusive social justice that has often been led by two groups of people who are, again, mutually inclusive, young people, students, children who are aware of the fact that adults often stand in contradiction and purport to care about things that they don't actually live up to. We can have a whole nother conversation about how y'all's president is a living embodiment of that in this moment. And Black queer people who continue to sacrifice and who literally are risking their lives to protest in a global pandemic to remind the world that all Black lives matter, right? What is not lost on me is that so many more people are just beginning to have this conversation, and a significant number of them are tripping over themselves and are doing harm by prioritizing their feelings over recognizing and appreciating that there have been people doing this work long before it was trending, and who will remain long after people no longer care to engage in this conversation because they have a privilege of choosing not to. Yeah. And so thinking about and being in community with my folks, folks who are race warriors, folks who are social justice warriors, folks who understand that if we want justice for ourselves, then we should want it for everybody else, continue to give me hope, because it is those people that are in the arena. I think that there's also this thing happening in the world that happened in the 60s where the way that we told the story suggested that everybody was in doing this work. And that's not true. Most people are still wrapped up in their privilege and are choosing not to become active accomplices, right? There's still too many people who are saying, I'm not a racist. I didn't enslave anyone. I'm not profiting from the pain of Black people or benefiting from the death of Black people. That is not enough. In this moment, at a minimum, you should be an anti-racist. Mm-hmm. You should become active in not becoming homophobic. You should be an accomplice in ensuring that we celebrate the lives of Black trans women before we talk about them when they die. Those are all things that people should not need to be taught to do, right? I think about how much I know about the experiences of Jewish people and the Holocaust, the internment of Asian Americans in this country. It would be nice if privileged non-Black people would read a book, would consult Google, would do anything connected to American history. Black people built this country for free. And it's important for folks to have this conversation outside of Black History Month and now Pride Month.
Yes. David J. Johns is the tireless executive director of the National Black Justice Coalition, a civil rights organization dedicated to the empowerment of Black, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer LGBTQ people. Previously, David served as the first executive director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans under President Barack Obama. Thank you for taking some time to visit with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Welton, for making space and for using your privilege to get your people to be better so we can all be better together.